wanted to just, you know, give a response to what has happened with El Paso, but also tell us about the event that you're part of helping to organize for the 49th and leading into the 50th, because there is a connection with what happened with the moratorium then and what's happening with the communities now.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad that you presented this clip. You know, with the original Chicano moratoriums, that was a part of it, you know, the killings of Chicanos overseas in Vietnam, but also police brutality, police terror. And, you know, and I live in Boyle Heights, and in 2016, we had a massive number of killings just in our small neighborhood. There were six in under a year. Mm. And it was horrendous. Two of them were teenagers, a 16-year-old named Jose Mendez and a 14-year-old named Jesse Romero. And so, you know, we've been doing this Chicano moratorium at Centro CSO for the past 5 years. The 49th is going to include different speakers who have had police brutality affect their families. One speaker, her name is Lisa Vargas. Her son was killed on August 27th of 2018. It just became the first year anniversary. And, you know, it was horrendous. He was killed down by a mistaken identity. East LA Sheriff said that, you know, he may have been a robber. There were reports of two different thieves in that barrio. And they ended up just shooting him because he ran. Just how you said, you know, you have a target on your back. And they shot him in the back. And the next day, East LA Sheriff said, you know, we didn't catch our robbers. Can you help us locate them? So why did they kill Anthony? You know, so she'll be speaking. And, you know, like you said, we are gearing up for the 50th, where our organization, Centro CSO, is part of a broader coalition that's made up of teachers, different people from around the, you know, Los Angeles, but all over Aslan or the Chicano Nation. And we're coming together to put it on. There's a big fundraiser that's happening on September 29th, I believe it is. And it's going to be at Rudy's. And we do invite folks to come out. But, you know, this is an ongoing movement. Mm-hmm. What happened in El Paso, you know, with the racist driving from Dallas, which is, you know, hours and hours away from El Paso. He wrote this horrible manifesto where he said, you know, we're under attack. Basically, he said that he didn't like the browning of America. And, you know, that's, I mean, where were these states before? You
make
know?
America white. You can't got to take off again because it wasn't. People who want to know about this event, about the 49th anniversary of the Chicano moratorium and the 50th coming up.
Absolutely.
And then a quick final thought from you, Teresa and Bill.
Okay, so today it's happening at Self Help Graphics, which is in Boyle Heights. It's happening between the hours of 6 and 9. And please come out if you can. It's going to be free and open to the public. There's going to be food, music, art, and poetry.
And we're putting that up. That'll be on our social media. And Carlos Montes, also a longtime activist, Jose Rodriguez, Jorge Rodriguez, and others are involved in some of this organizing as well. Teresa, just a quick final thought from you.
You know, I often tell my students that when you accept the term Chicana as your identity, that along with it comes the responsibility to engage in class and anti-racist struggle. And while it's important to commemorate the moratorium, it's also very important to recognize that our struggle continues today. And that would be my message.
Bill.
Yeah, I just want to say that, Margaret, you know, we've had this target on our backs since annexation. And it was the annexation that really enabled the United States to become a superpower. Those lands, fertile agricultural lands, oil lands, all of that. But it also sealed our oppression and it created something new and unique, the Chicano and Chicana people. And this ethnic cleansing that's going on didn't just start in El Paso. You know, in 89, there was a white racist that went down to a McDonald's in San Diego and slaughtered 21 of us. And said, you know, he wanted to kill the Mexicans. So this is something that's kind of rooted in U.S. history and U.S. reality. And it should tell us that this country is trying to, I think, very deliberately move towards a form of institutionalized apartheid. So part of that is aimed at us. Part of that is aimed at the black liberation struggle. But it's something that all people who care about democracy, who care about justice, should be aware of and should be joining with us on occasions like the Chicano moratorium to really build the kind of movement we need to transform this country fundamentally.
Right. Well, on that note, I'm sorry to say we are out of time. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Teresa Montaño, Sol Marquez, Bill Gallegos. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. Today's show, Oregon, produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You are listening to KBO Portland. The time is 9:04. Next up, we have a KBO Public Affairs special with a look at the 1970 Vortex Music Festival.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Dresden, and today we'll be talking about Vortex One, the only state-sponsored rock festival in United States history. Vortex was held in 1970, during the Vietnam War, in order to prevent violence between 50,000 anti-war demonstrators and 25,000 pro-war legionnaires. Both groups had targeted Portland as a place of demonstration during Labor Day week. Governor Tom McCall, understanding the potential for wide-scale conflict, collaborated with long-haired hippies to find an alternative gathering for the anti-war demonstrators. What they agreed on would result in Vortex One, a biodegradable festival of life. At its peak, 40,000 people were in attendance at this state-sponsored festival, which was hosted 25 miles away from the city. The event was a success, and no one was harmed during the demonstrations in Portland. Vortex One is remembered as Oregon's Woodstock, a celebration of peace and love. Up next is a conversation with an artist who performed at the event, Lloyd Jones.
What was it like being there? What did it look like? I know 40,000 people is a statistic I can throw out there, but that doesn't give me much by way of, like, what was the atmosphere? What were people wearing? How diverse was everyone's background? Was it a very specific age group that was coming out, or was it varied?
In that period of time, everybody was open to spontaneity, so it wasn't planning. There was no one in charge of anything. And people just showed up because there's something going on. And they literally slept on the ground. And so trying to walk over there, I'm stepping on people on the ground that I can't see, so I'm having to go really slow. And they'd laugh. You know, nobody got mad if somebody tripped or fell or something. It didn't start a fight. It was, they'd laugh because everybody was getting high and laughing and just being goofy.
So it was a massive communal campground.
Yeah.
With not a lot of lighting, darkness as far as the eye could see, and you didn't know when you were going to like step over someone. Like if they didn't have their lighter on, then you didn't know they were there. But they didn't take offense to it if you scuffed
your
shoe.
Laugh, and then you might sit down, and they might have a reef or something, and then you'd giggle and just talk about what a nice night it was. And then you'd wander off somewhere and stumble around, and everybody was open and visiting with each other.
Cool. Let's talk more about the vibe. What were these commandments that the Vortex audience seemed to have in common?
I felt that there was such a great feeling of interaction. People talked about the nudity and that, and some of the point of that was that you could feel safe, that everyone was on the same page about looking out for one another, caring about one another, and there wasn't hostility. And to imagine a culture where the idea of hostility would be so obscene that the whole community would just gather around and calm them down and just say, no, you know, that would just be against everything that we believe and care about. And you didn't, it was taboo, you just didn't want to go there. And there you had a culture that was not violent. I had later on some younger people come to me just a few years ago, just finding out about Vortex thing, and saying there was no one in charge. You know, there were no sheriffs there. There were no disciplinary things, and it was scary. And I said, no, you don't understand. It wasn't scary, and that was the point. Is everyone was sharing and looking out for one another and caring about one another, and that was the most important thing.
How do you think you invite? Because I know that Vortex had on record 40,000 people on its largest day.
All right.
How do you ensure that all 40,000 are of this wavelength? Like how do you avoid getting bad apples who are looking to start trouble or are looking to push bad drugs that are laced with something that consumers aren't aware of?
That's what was so interesting to me, and that now it's hard to imagine that. But then it wasn't. It was so wrong to be violent or to be aggressive in that way. It was just, ew, you know what, you don't want to do that. So you would be surrounded with kindness and you just wouldn't go there. There was no support for that. It was more about just the social interaction of all ages, all groups, all races. Everything was about... One thing that when I look back and think that everyone was welcome, the point was everyone's welcome, everyone's safe. Let's have an existence where everybody looks out for one another. We care about each other. Don't want to hurt anybody. Anything is okay to do as long as no one gets hurt.
How does a group of 40,000 people all converge on those ideals?
Well, it was temporary. Let's just go. And they were all wondering. I think everybody there was going, wow, this is different. And let's look around. And then wander around, and there was a river that went by, and everybody was swimming in the river naked, and everybody was going, well, okay, whatever. And somebody else had bongos in the dirt, and it was just fun. It was, you know, for a place that was no supervision, no organization, no planning, no advertising, it just developed over a time period.
So it seems like almost otherworldly that 40,000 people with shared values can come together and celebrate their shared values without knowing ahead of time what the values would have been.
Well, remember that this is going on in San Francisco before that. Mm-hmm. This was the way the culture was going in that generation, Woodstock, all those things. It was everywhere. Let's look at things differently. Let's stop with the war. You know, Lenin was out there doing his songs about peace and love, and it was a peace and love thing. That was the whole crux of the issue.
So it wasn't something that was just limited to Oregon. Like the
right.
Generation all throughout America was leaning towards peace and love if you weren't part of the Legionnaires. And so leaning towards peace and love, you could just naturally assume that other people would be like-minded. You could go to events like Vortex and naturally assume, like, I'm going to find people who are... Is hippies a derogatory term? Do you prefer the term long hair, or...?
Yeah, any of that's fine. It was a peace-love thing, and, yeah. You know, I think Tom McCall was saying, well, why don't you just enjoy your peace-love thing that was going on everywhere, and why don't you just go over and do that over there,
yeah,
and just keep it separate so we don't have a riot downtown.
So it's not
it
like,
worked.
Yeah, it's not like Vortex created the peace and love vibe. It just capitalized on it.
Bingo. Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you mentioned how it seems like we've been receding in terms of the peace and love vibe.
The first sign that was troubling to me was, because I thought we were there, I'm looking around going, yeah, this, you know, we're on the right page, and it's great to see we're solving these problems together, all together, and we're out looking out for each other and trying to make it a better place. And then I'd gone to several concerts. There was a Charles Lloyd concert in Washington Park that was like, the, you know, they had the dog with the scarf and the drumstick and the wine bottle and everybody rolling around on the grass, and it was fun. Well, only about a year or two later, we played in Washington Park, and it was everything was organized now. Everything had gone corporate. They had tables, and they had the sweaters tied around their neck, and they would sip Perrier water, and they didn't clap, and they didn't dance, and they didn't interact, and then they went home.
It was commercial and snobby.
And everything was stone corporate, to the point that I thought, what happened? And then I look around and go, it's not another generation has just walked over it and passed it. It's the same people.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it became about, oh, money. That was cute. That was fun. But anyway, money. But the, what really made the major change was when Martin Luther King got killed.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I saw music change from... before that, you know, Wilson Pickett, like I was saying, Otis Redding, Aretha Franklin, you'd get mixed crowds, black and white, and everybody digging the music, and it's out on the airwaves, and everybody's on the same page again. And then Martin Luther King gets killed, and it's like the wall went up, and now it's you got the rap starting, and it's all mean-spirited hate rap, and then mm-hmm. the white audience, it's heavy metal, anger-driven, mm-hmm. and both sides are kind of anger-driven music that wasn't joyous anymore.
Yeah.
So for me, that was a, whoa, what happened? I thought, what, aren't we doing this anymore? Aren't we going to be friendly anymore? And it was heartbreaking.
And so once, like, the prominent advocate for seeing each other for each other's character, like, had been assassinated, it seems like the movement for coming together as one community fell apart. Is that what you're trying to say? Is that what you're saying, actually?
I just thought we'd kind of overcome and solved a lot of problems, and then I came to realize, guess not. And it's kind of a shame to see it keep going back, and it's worse now than ever. And I just lived through a little vortex moment where it was really like that, and I believed it.
It's something to really dive into, how the same generation who could go to an event like Vortex and completely embody the peace and love community could within the span of a decade make it about the money. And so you mentioned how Martin Luther King's passing played a part in that. What else do you feel could have been a variable?
I think it just gets down to that fight. Newt Gingrich really made it a war against the other party. He's the one who started that, or really enforced that kind of behavior. And then we're not working together anymore. And Vortex was about working together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a matter of us making a conscious decision of where our values are at. Do we want to solve problems together and make a better community, or we just want money?
Like, it seemed like after Vortex, we've kind of took our foot off the gas.
Yeah, it's kind of gone from a we generation to a me generation kind of thing. So it's, you're not really worried about the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that showed the possibility. If we had a more unifying spokesman or group that was talking about, I don't see anybody on right now on the scene anywhere talking about us, trying to us, you know,
right.
Bringing people together. There's usually a specific goal for a specific small group of people. It's not a unifying bringing it together.
Sure.
In a positive, uplifting way for everyone. It should work for everyone. One of the things I really liked about Martin Luther King's whole, his whole concept worked for everyone in every situation. It didn't exclude anybody. It was, his values were for everyone, and that was a good, healthy, positive outlook. And then he gets killed, and it's just heartbreaking to me that we don't have a voice for that I see right now.
And because there was a lack of a voice, the default mode for people to operate within was the acquisition of money, it sounds like, because that's been the growing trend ever since.
Yeah.
I know Tom McCall sanctioned pot and nudity to run rampant at this festival. Would it have been successful? Would it have been a successful event without sanctioning those things?
I didn't know he did. And, you know, I didn't know all those things. I didn't know he was responsible for any of it. Just a friend of mine sits doing sound and said, you got to come out and play at this thing. It was a wing ding and it was fun. So I don't think he was making any documented statement about that. I think he was just trying to get people to go over there and have fun over there and don't come downtown and riot.
Yeah.
I don't think he made it. And be sure and take some pot and some acid when you go. I don't think he was saying that. He was just saying, just just go over there and do whatever you would like to do over there, and just go do it over there.
Got it. So he didn't have to say, like, hey, pot and nudity is going to be okay. Like, the movement and the people were already going to bring it, and he didn't necessarily say it couldn't happen. And in not saying it couldn't happen, he almost, like, invited it
you
to
won't
happen.
Be there's not going to be deputies all over taking everybody to jail that lights up a reefer. Just going to say, we're just going to leave you alone to do whatever you want for a couple of days over there.
And it doesn't matter if that agreement was verbalized and made public, as long as the event was going to happen, like, those qualities were going to surface anyway.
That's what was going on at the time.
Yeah.
People were experimenting with everything.
So it was to be expected, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of people probably experimented with drugs for a few years that never did again. It was just... Everyone was, the culture was at that time, because like Purple Osley acid came out, and that no one knew what that was, and you would hallucinate and go, what does that mean? So someone else would take it, and then everybody's wondering about that, so that's what was going on at the time. And then you get bored with it after you've done it for a while, but it was just what was new and exciting at the time.
Got it. So one of the things I want to know is, again, there was a lot of like-mindedness at Vortex. What would happen, or did you see any situation where someone was against the grain? Like, if someone was exhibiting properties, or
anywhere.
There were
a couple of times where there was like an OD problem, where somebody was out of control, and there's times they just took too much and whatever, and they had a tent for that. But I can remember somebody, not really violent, but just losing it, you know, and a group of people would just gather around and like comfort them and sit next to them and hold their hand, and they'd bring water and they'd say, but this guy needs help, and maybe we can get somebody, you know, a paramedic in here or something. But they just were focused on helping them. So if there was ever some problem like that, of which there was very little that I ever saw, that's what was so amazing about it, was that many people just being happy.
All of a sudden, spontaneous altruism. It sounds like where if someone was in need and people saw that...
They rushed to help them.
And that was the norm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was the point, was then the message was, let's help one another. So that's why when you went to the nudity and things, you could say, you know, women can be without clothes and not be afraid of being attacked or being aggressive. People, you know, an uncomfortable situation. It's natural. Mm-hmm. And they'd just be natural. And during that little time period, everybody respected everybody's space in that way. So that was another uniqueness about it. And I know that's not reality, but for a moment, it was delightful to see people be respectable of each other.
Well, Lloyd, I really loved having you on the series. Thanks for coming and talking to me about Vortex today.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. It's great.
Yeah, Lloyd Jones, everyone. Good vibes only. My name is Dresden. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Dresden.
Cool.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Dresden, and today we'll be talking about Vortex One, the only state-sponsored rock festival in United States history. Vortex was held in 1970, during the Vietnam War, in order to prevent violence between 50,000 anti-war demonstrators and 25,000 pro-war legionnaires. Both groups had targeted Portland as a place of demonstration during Labor Day week. Governor Tom McCall, understanding the potential for wide-scale conflict, collaborated with long-haired hippies to find an alternative gathering for the anti-war demonstrators. What they agreed on would result in Vortex One, a biodegradable festival of life. At its peak, 40,000 people were in attendance at this state-sponsored festival, which was hosted 25 miles away from the city. The event was a success, and no one was harmed during the demonstrations in Portland. Vortex One is remembered as Oregon's Woodstock, a celebration of peace and love. Up next is a conversation with a writer who documented the event, Matt Love.
It was a Republican governor facing re-election. The Democrat Bob Straub he was running against was against Vortex. I mean, most people can't, when you tell them the story and they don't know it, they're like, what? A Republican governor did what? There was a rock festival where people went out and people got naked and smoked pot out in the open and swam naked in the Clackamas River, you know? I think that's the mind-blowing aspect. And that's why I call it the far-out story of Vortex One, because it was just far out.
One of the things that was celebrated by the Vortex community was that, and it was evident in your book, that it was a pot and nude festival that was paid for by the governor. Do you feel like it would have been a successful event even without the allowance of pot and nudity?
Yeah, I mean, that was going to happen. I mean, if they had sent in the National Guard or the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department and busted everybody, can you imagine the headlines that would have been? I mean, it would have been a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it, McCall and crew and some of the Clackamas County Sheriff's deputies that I interviewed, they placed faith. You know, they like, let's go for it. Let's take a risk and try to pull this off. And they all came together. It sounds corny to say it, but it worked.
And so it's almost as if they didn't need to announce that they weren't going to crack down on pot and nudity. They knew it was going to happen as a byproduct of having a festival for long hairs.
Well, it was widely known. I think the word got out that, and it was known that there wasn't going to be uniform law and presence in the park. I mean, that was implicit to everybody. I think it was even stated. But the National Guard, of course, was called out on a training exercise, which was pretty interesting, unarmed, by the way. And they were all around the park. If you've ever been to McIver Park, you know there's only one way in, one way out. That was why it was selected, Westerdahl told me, because they could corral them, that's his verb, if things got out of control. So they had things in place if it got out of control. But it didn't. I mean, it was a success. Way more people went than they ever imagined, and certainly more than made it into the press accounts or Brent Wall's book.
Right.
He vastly underestimated the number of people there, because I had access to Oregon Department of Transportation aerial photos and all these estimates of their spotters. I mean, over that whole four-day weekend, like 100,000 people. McCall laid down the law. You know, when he gave his speech to the Oregon public on television, it's speech where he says, you're going to do this, this, and this. You're going to behave. This is your alternatives to milling madness. Vortex was authorized as a safety valve. And to you, I mean, he's telling them, you know, you're going to behave. I mean, it was an incredible lecture from Tom McCall facing re-election, and people listened. And I read hundreds of telegrams sent to McCall's office, and like, the speech was a masterstroke, because the people who hated Vortex thought that McCall was getting tough on the hippies, and then the people who were in favor of Vortex thought, my God, this guy's enlightened, and he's sanctioning a rock festival. He hit them both, and it was just a total home run.
Were there any common trends in terms of age, in terms of cultural background? Was it pretty diverse, ethnically speaking?
It wasn't diverse. We're talking about Oregon in 1970, okay? So I have interviewed a couple African-Americans who were there, including the hot dog vendor, who was an African-American man who had a red balloon around his penis and advertised for hot dogs.
Yeah.
Hot dog. So that's one of my favorite stories.
That'll catch your attention, yeah.
Yes, and I guess it was successful, because a lot of people mentioned this hot dog vendor. But there just simply wasn't, a major Latino community or African-American community in Portland at that time, or even now, as much, you know, as in other states. So it was white, overwhelming. I mean, there was a lot of young people, but, you know, a lot of older people who came out and saw what was going on. And I say, you know, it was young people. It was this was the era, rock music, Woodstock. You know, Woodstock 50 is going on right now, you know, and I mean, the memory of it anyway. And so it wasn't, you know, culturally diverse. A lot of, of course, you know, gender, men and women. And it was that era, too, where, you know, there was a lot of sexism in the anti-war movement, and the counterculture movement was rampant at that time. And so there was that. There wasn't really any, you know, major females who were in charge, except for the exception of Krista Hansen that I know of, that I really interviewed and found. I found some great women to talk to, but it was sort of a, you know, males ran the Vortex show, but at the party, everybody came out there.
In doing the detective work, how did you feel drawn to it?
I grew up in Oregon City. I'd heard about it in Clackamas County. Then I found the booklet in a secondhand store in Lincoln City. Something spoke to me, and I don't even like large public gatherings. I probably wouldn't have even gone to Vortex, because, you know, like, I don't like crowds, and Here's what drew me to it: the risk taking. You know, I hate the word bipartisanship because it doesn't mean anything, but they really came together. The young people and McCall, the hippies, state parks employees. I was like, when I started digging into this and reading and interviewing people, I just could not believe the levels of collaboration and open-mindedness. And like, that's why the story still resonates with me. You can hear it, the intonation of my voice right now. I still can't believe it even happened. And that, it imbues me. It's always imbued me about working with other people, you know, reaching across the aisle. We've got to solve some problems in Oregon, you know, and like they did. Now it was a one-off, but maybe there's something there.
And so you had long hairs and you had politicians in suits coming together at the table and figuring out solutions.
Robert Warren, the timber magnate, and Dr. Cameron Bangs, a doctor, you know, like this amalgam of Oregonians coming together to solve a problem and setting aside the ideology, not taking, you know, their sound bites from national news organizations or political party leaders. Like, it was just so homegrown.
Do you think that if the state were to ask in return, like, okay, we'll allow this to happen, but the community itself has to put it together, do you think the community would rise to the occasion?
Yeah, I think they would. I mean, McIver Park is pretty much the same as it was back then. I mean, the field where the bands went on is still there. It's a model airplane field. I mean, they have a frisbee golf course down there and along the river, but it's the same park. The same buildings are there where they serve the food and the restaurant. I mean, it's like you walk through there, and anytime you ever go to McIver Park and you walk around there, you'll see somebody walking around, and believe me, they were at Vortex. I've gone out there probably 50 times in the last 15 years, and every time I go, someone's out there remembering, taking their grandkids. Hey, I went to a rock festival. I was cool once. But we were also, you know, most people didn't even know there was a political association Vortex, to be honest with you.
And why do you feel that people are still nostalgic for that time?
Because we solved the problem, you know? And people, there's, you know, in Brent Wall's biography of McCall, he says that, you know, it was overblown, that it didn't really work. Okay, that's not true. I interviewed dozens of people who said they were going down to protest in Portland. They heard there was going to be a rock festival, including some members of the People's Army Jamboree, and they went out to Vortex. It pulled hundreds of people off the streets of Portland who may have got involved in some kind of altercation, because there was agent provocateurs embedded in the anti-war movement all over this country, and they were the ones that usually threw the rocks or, you know, did led to the cops busting heads. So it worked. It pulled people out of Portland, the diffusing mechanism. Now, it was a one-off, but I think people remember Vortex because it was a damn good time, for one thing, and they got to be free, but it worked. Something in government worked.
Yeah. So it sounds like it was important that other people hear the story. What difference do you feel it makes when other people hear the story of Vortex?
I think they're inspired by it. I mean, they're totally inspired by it. We can do something. I mean, everybody, you get a room of people, and if I give a presentation on it and I show the photographs, or you listen to McCall's speech, they're just like, my God, how did we do that? Like, can't we do something like that again? Not stage a rock festival, but come together and solve some problems. And, you know, that's what I think people are really drawn to it. Even both sides of the political aisle, you know, I did hundreds of presentations about Vortex over the years before the book came out and then afterwards, and then shows like this, and that's always been what's really struck me, is that people want to belong to something where you solve a problem, people come together, and we move forward, and let's go solve the next problem.
And Vortex is a life-affirming spectacle which demonstrates where people came together to solve a problem.
Yeah, and like I said also, it was fun. It was a party, okay? So, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, too.
Right. Education through entertainment.
And so people had fun, and let's shake hands. Let's talk. Mm-hmm. Okay? I mean, it's just to get us on the field together, man. I like to talk.
Get us on the field together.
Some political boosts. And, you know, my suggestion was you put NARAL right next to NRA. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And let's talk.
Similar to how the long hairs and the suited politicians were able to get together and talk.
Right. They just, you just talk. And you don't, but let's, you know, everything you hear almost on both sides of the aisle is just sound bites. Like, let's go out there and talk. Let's have some original thoughts and reflect on Vortex. And I'd love to write a sequel to the book. I have one in mind, a very short, little, longish 10,000 word book, if we can get the financing for it, to recollect or to what Vortex was. But let's go forward with that spirit. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds so idealistic, you know, but why not?
Do you think that there was a lot of people hashing it out at the festival? I imagine there was more of a focus on people partying together and being naked together.
I think there were, I read, you know, a lot of the Legionnaires that were bored with their party, they came out there. Like, some guardsmen went off hours, off duty. They went in. Mm-hmm. Some of the rednecks out in Clackamas County surely went in. There's pictures of them, for Christ's sake, you know? Mm-hmm. And so who knows what went on there? You're just on the same field together. One of my favorite photographs in the book is there's a obviously a logger. He's wearing logging jeans, and he's got the logging aluminum helmet. He's got suspenders, and he's wearing, I think he's wearing cork boots, for Christ's sake. And he's got a Heidelberg bottle in his back pocket, okay? Mm-hmm. And the 32-ounce Heidelberg bottle, they don't make it anymore. But he's out there with his girlfriend, and they're holding hands, and around them is just these people dancing, you know? And so surely there might have been some insults or some derision, but maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe those people started talking to these people. I don't know.
Right.
They were there, though. The logger with the Heidelberg came to the park to see the freak show, but maybe the freak show wasn't the freak show. Maybe he had fun. Maybe he heard something. Maybe he dropped acid, you know, and had a revelation. You know, who knows? But if they did it then, you know, why not?
Yeah, it begins with sharing the field.
And it's more timely now than it was in 1970.
Awesome. You know? Wait, so more timely now. In 1970, there was a war.
I know, but it's just like, just the idea that young people in the moment where the draft is on and people are dying, they decided to reach out to their government, you know, a Republican government, and to ask for help. Now, that's more timely than ever.
Yeah.
You know, to solve a problem, to forestall violence, to buck conventional wisdom. And Westerdahl could have just laughed, or they would set him out in the lobby and never took their, their meeting, the call. Nothing. Then we have nothing.
Right.
So that's more timely than ever. People reaching out, solving problems, putting aside partisan labels, ideologues, you know, memes, and just vitriol. I'm just so tired of that on both ends of this. The judgment, the meanness, like, let's just get together. I know that sounds so pie in the sky, but man, what else is the alternative?
Right. And I definitely feel like I'm very appreciative of your work. Like you said, if you hadn't documented it, a lot of this would have been lost to the wayside. And in doing the detective work to really recognize Vortex for what happened, your book was very influential for me, and you've done
great
service.
Well, thank you. It's still out there. It's invariably, whenever you write a book about a historical event, as soon as the book comes out, you always find out there's better stories that once the book's been published.
Yeah.
And that's a rule of thumb.
Yeah.
So I would like to take another run at that. I'm not sure how we're going to do that, but I'll, where there's a will, there's a way, because I did it the first time.
Yeah, where there's a will, there's a vortex, apparently.
That's right, Ron.
Yeah, cool. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
All right, good night. Take care.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Dresden, and today we'll be talking about Vortex One, the only state-sponsored rock festival in United States history. Vortex was held in 1970, during the Vietnam War, in order to prevent violence between 50,000 anti-war demonstrators and 25,000 pro-war Legionnaires. Both groups had targeted Portland as a place of demonstration during Labor Day week. Governor Tom McCall, understanding the potential for wide-scale conflict, collaborated with long-haired hippies to find an alternative gathering for the anti-war demonstrators. What they agreed on would result in Vortex One, a biodegradable festival of life. At its peak, 40,000 people were in attendance at this state-sponsored festival, which was hosted 25 miles away from the city. The event was a success, and no one was harmed during the demonstrations in Portland.
Vortex One is remembered as Oregon's Woodstock, a celebration of peace and love. Up next is a conversation with an organizer who initially pitched the idea to the governor's office, Lee Meyer, alongside a friend who'd attended the festival, Dave Dumas.
I know that the festival really came together in response to the violence of the Vietnam War. And one of the commandments, so to speak, of Vortex One was peace and love and coming together as a community. What are other commandments that you would like to incorporate into the ideology of Vortex?
Sharing. People were sharing. And that was really cool.
There was a lot of cooperation. It was all about peace and love, you know? That was pretty much it. Make love, not war.
Yeah.
You know? And what we wanted to show was that there was another way of living. I mean, at that time, we were all young. We were in our 20s. And I think at that age, you think you can actually change the world.
Well, yeah. We were trying to create a paradigm shift. And I think that we were starting to see that happen by that time period, you know? You know, there was a national student strike. We shut down colleges all around the country, you know, and that was what we, you know, we wanted to end that war. We wanted to get the guys home, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
And how could you ensure that everyone in attendance to this free festival was going to be able to resonate with its values? Because I know that there are isolated incidents, but there are still incidents where people were being antagonizing or people were pushing bad drugs. And so how did you prepare for that before the festival came to be?
I don't know. We had people there who were dealing with drug overdoses. We had people there that were dealing with fire problems. We had a fire crew. We also had the Rainbow family who came up at the time they were just forming, the Rainbow family. It was Garrick Beck's group of people that's now gone on to international fame. Yeah. But it was he and his group of people that were doing a lot of the just morale building of the whole situation. And our approach to it was that we would overpower negative situations with positive energy. Yeah. You know, we would just surround people that were fighting and
it was actually working.
So how did people find all of these niche roles to be filled for the festival to come together? Was there an organizer telling people like, hey, we need, I guess, reaching out to the crowd and saying, hey, does anyone want to like donate food? Does anyone want to help construct the stage? Was there any head that was directing volunteers?
As far as I know, there wasn't. Not that I'm aware of. There was no coordination on that level. The most coordination that I saw was the 2 months preceding the festival when we were all upstairs making phone calls and trying to gather resources. And, you know, fear is a big motivating factor, too. And the City of Portland Club, I don't know if that's the name. Anyway, they were involved.
The City Club.
City Club. Yeah. Berkman, right. was one of the guys. I can't remember what his first name was. But they were involved. There were all sorts of people involved in the business community who were more than willing to donate money and resources to avert a disaster on their buildings downtown. So it's my understanding that the materials from the stage were donated by the local businesses in Portland that were afraid of violence. So they were trying to help things out.
It seems like there was a citywide awareness where if this festival doesn't go according to plan, we have the potential for like our cityscape to be a war zone. And so as a result, there really was a unique sense of urgency for this to be done. And I guess it's really interesting how this sense of impending doom motivated people to band together and create a declaration of love. And I'm curious to hear whether or not that's close to what the atmosphere was at Vortex.
From my perspective, I was there for about 2 weeks, about a week before the official event and then a week after. And I don't remember any fights or any confrontations at all.
What did Vortex One look like for someone who didn't know what the festival was and was just checking it out because they'd heard about the hype?
There were a lot of visitors the weekend of the festival. Like, there were loggers in tin hats and sawed-off pants with bottles of beer sticking out their back pockets. Okay. There were all kinds of voyeurs there who wanted to see naked girls.
There were a lot of naked people there. You know, people were being free and skinny dipping and all this kind of stuff.
There was, so yeah.
Just kind of being ourselves, really.
There was a mud sauna and there was a regular steam sauna, hot rock sauna. They were built out of these plastic kind of structures.
They were really simple, real simple.
And they were right on the river's edge so that people would soak in the hot tubs, or not hot tubs, the saunas.
In the steam baths, yeah.
Right, and then go out and dive in the river. And that was a big attraction point for a lot of visitors that were curious to see naked people.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of tourists came in, so that was kind of interesting.
But you,
some of them got involved in the things and some of them didn't. Like, yeah. I was skinny dipping with some people and this early crowd came in and they were up in the fence line and they were watching us. And I said, you know, come on down and take off your clothes and you can get a better look. And like half of them did. And the other half kind of looked embarrassed and like went away. So the funny things like that were happening all the time there, you know, just different things like that. So it's kind of like they came to see maybe a freak show. I'm not sure. You know, we were the freaks, you know, so that's okay.
Definitely.
But
well, my parents came out that weekend and the traffic was phenomenal. The traffic stretched 17 miles from McIver Park back towards Portland. I mean, McIver's a long ways from Portland. That's probably what? From downtown Portland, it's probably 30 miles.
I think it's 25.
25, something like that.
Were there any mishaps that happened at the festival that needed an organizer's attention?
Just minor injuries. You know, they had the medical tent. So
there was a medical tent. Then there was the talk down tents for drug emergencies where people were just, you know, overdosed.
By and large, the recurring theme that I'm hearing is that there was this unparalleled level of trust in each other. I think there was an unparalleled level of trust in the sense that at this festival, you have 40,000 people strong interacting, trying to have a good time, and the worst thing that happened was a bad trip or a minor injury. Like, you didn't need security, you didn't need someone constantly organizing it, you didn't need to have volunteers ensuring that people were complying with the code of conduct.
Well, you're just naming what everybody did there. We were our own security. We were all our own volunteers. If somebody was having a problem, people around them just stepped in and took care of the problem. If somebody started shouting, you know, you'd chill them out and say, what's the problem? Mm-hmm. Let's take care of the problem. So it was like you didn't have this force of people moving through there doing this policing and stuff. It was everybody was doing that.
Yeah, there was no police force there at all. I mean, we found out afterwards that Westerdahl had stationed the National Guard and barns up on the ridge above the river, but we had no idea about that.
Yeah,
we didn't. And I guess there were some sequestered in a building in the park.
Right.
I mean, I feel sorry for these poor National Guard guys.
There.
It was hot.
They were
all
like
stuffed into barns. Yeah, you know, right. It's like it's crazy.
Yeah, they were told not to make a presence. Right.
Right. Right. Yes.
But did everyone?
There were no police presence.
They were standing by, is what
they were standing by.
Yeah.
Got it.
Right.
But did everyone in attendance know that just around the corner was a policing force if they needed
anyone?
No.
Wow.
I didn't find out until 50 years later.
Yeah.
40 years later.
Yeah, when Matt checked it all out.
Yeah.
Wow. So as you were saying earlier, there was this self-empowered feeling that was common amongst those in attendance, where if there needed to be security, you would be security. If someone needed help, you would be the one that helped them. And so there really seemed to be an awareness that even though I don't know you, I'm going to function as the best possible community member toward you. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I think that's probably it, yeah.
And I'm curious if you feel like there were very strong cultural ramifications as a result of Vortex One having existed.
The governor got elected or reelected.
He thought he was committing political suicide, and it definitely worked in his favor.
I think generally the idea of the people that lived in the state of Oregon at the time, they saw it as a successful thing, you know, no matter what your ideology was or what you were thinking about anything.
Yeah, I think it was very successful. I have Michael Carr was one of the people that went down to the governor's office with me, and he to this day thinks that we sold out. So he's not, in retrospect, he's not real proud of Vortex.
In what ways does he feel Vortex?
He feels like we sold out and that we should have been in town protesting. And there are, you know, there is that perspective. And I just disagree. I think making a positive statement is more important than reacting to a negative one.
Did you ever have an otherworldly experience where you were walking around and thought to yourself, man, this was just a car drive to Ed Westerdahl. This is surreal.
I was very thankful to Ed Westerdahl and to Governor Tom McCall. I thought it was a great event. I think it succeeded at what we set out to do. As far as I know, there was only one plate glass window in downtown Portland that was broken. It was at Myron Frank. And so I think we succeeded in our goal of making a positive statement and avoiding a head-on confrontation, which is...
And there was a demonstration in Portland as well.
The People's Army Jamboree stayed in Portland, and they had a march and,
About 1,000 people, right?
Yeah.
So if the 60s were really about activism and going out and doing things, when did the culture of the nation shift to being a lot more passive?
Well, I'm not so sure that it has. I mean, you saw the confrontation yesterday between the Proud Boys and the anti-fascists. Uh-huh. I think people are involved. That's definitely another situation where there's a big potential for violence.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we're still facing a lot of negative energy and war, endless wars. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that we need to change.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, a festival of positive statements might be helpful, but I don't think it kind of lacks the context of that specific event, which, you know, it solved the problem of people confronting each other violently.
Sure. And change isn't going to come from a week-long festival, regardless of how great the festival is.
No, not really.
Yeah. You gotta carry that wavelength into your everyday life and spread it in your community.
Yeah.
And keep the pressure on. You need to keep doing stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. People get cynical too easy, I think. And like Lee says, be positive. You know, think, don't fall victim to negative, you know, impulses. You know, try to be positive and lift everything upward, you know, bring it up.
I think the most important thing right now is not a festival, but just getting people out to vote, to keep striving, you know. Striving for your ideals.
Well said. And that's what brought about Vortex. And that's what brought about the three of us meeting together.
Right.
And I'm so glad that we got to come together.
Yeah.
Dave, Lee, thanks for coming in and talking about Vortex One.
I appreciate it. Thank you,
Dresden. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Dresden, and today we'll be talking about Vortex One, the only state-sponsored rock festival in United States history. Vortex was held in 1970, during the Vietnam War, in order to prevent violence between 50,000 anti-war demonstrators and 25,000 pro-war legionnaires. Governor Tom McCall, understanding the potential, at its peak, 40,000 people were in attendance at this state-sponsored festival, which was hosted 25 miles away from the city. The event was a success, and no one was harmed during the demonstrations in Portland. Up next is a conversation with a Rainbow family member who witnessed the naming of the Rainbow Group at Vortex.
It's like we came in there as rainbow people. We thought of ourselves as rainbow people. And we were looking for a back to the land place that we could set up and grow organic foods and use alternative energies. And we referred to that place in our mind's eye as the rainbow place. Or a rainbow farm, or a rainbow village. But when we came to Vortex, around that big campfire in the middle of all those teepees, after the music had closed at the main stage, and people came down after a day of and an evening of partying, and people came down in the village, and the children came down, and the grown-ups came down. People brought out their drums, and we were making this organic music around the campfire. And it was in that scene there at Vortex that we, by poetry, really, took on the name Rainbow Family of Living Light. And that was like a poetic experiential moment, and it had stuck. I thought it was something that was a passing piece of art, but it turned out to be a name that now there's people using that name in 40 countries around the world, or 80 countries around the world. And again, this is not the only thing that came out of Vortex.
What do you think? What effects were produced by the festival that have been felt the last five decades?
Well, at events like this, at immersive events, where the public has to participate in order to help make it happen, right? Because you got Vortex, it's free. Whoever's parking the cars, whoever's cooking the food, whoever's dealing with the trash, whoever's building the stage, whoever's helping the act get on, whoever's hosting the workshops, whoever's doing anything, it's all got to be people standing up and volunteering. Nobody's paid to do it. So it's a public participatory experiential event, not a festival where you buy a ticket and go in and all those other jobs being taken care of by paid staffers.
So how did you convince the community to volunteer their time to put the event together?
Oh, I didn't have to convince them. This is a shared vision. People saw it. People said, oh, yeah, let's do it. Let's do it for free. Let's show off our good stuff. Let's show off our community spirit. Let's show off our community health care. Let's show off our community care for children. Let's show off our community arts and music. Let's show these things off and show that all we different people, all these people from all the spectra of society, can come together and make this community. And yes, it was very rock and roll centered, but it wasn't centered around Sony Music and Warner Brothers and MGM.
But speaking of the Rainbow Family, what was their primary role in Vortex?
That's a really good question. And what happened is we landed at the front gate of Vortex. The scene was already in process. I was not there when we landed at the park. The scene was already in process. But we had a caravan of about 80 people. And we were just full of ourselves. We were like, all right, we're here. What do we need to do? Boom, right at the top. People started working with parking. Boom, we went down further. People started working with building the stage. Boom, we went down further. We worked with the setting up the kitchen that Ben Wright from the Wayfarer Cafe and a whole bunch of others were putting together. Boom, we went down into the meadow. And we met with the Explorer Scouts, and we set up the teepees. And we had this group of people that had just been on this mountain, lake, a celebration adventure together, and we showed up at Vortex, and suddenly there was a whole group of competent people. Well, some of us were more spaced out than others, but a whole group of competent people who could pitch in at the kitchen, at the stage, at the teepee circle, at every other aspect of Vortex. And that was a boost right when the event needed it. And that again, we weren't the first people there. We didn't land and as it were, open the gate. But not everybody can do everything. The way the community works, the way community spirit works is you do your part, I do my part, he, she, they do their part, and wow, it happens.
So your part was coming in with the caravan and offering your services to where you were needed.
Bingo.
So you were at the airport.
Yes.
Where the American Legion was arriving to Portland, and you were handing out leaflets about peace and love, and how you were inviting people who were could easily have been framed as the enemy, but you saw them as, no, if this is going to be Vortex, everyone needs to be welcome.
Correct. We did that for about 4 hours one afternoon, maybe about six of us.
And how many people from the Legion or the Legionnaires came to Vortex?
Well, a couple of busloads came out, and some of them were looking for trouble, and some of them were looking to party. I recount that in my book, True Stories, which I would love to do a reading of somewhere in Portland, Powell's or Reed College or someplace.
So how did you deal with the bus of people that wanted to cause trouble?
Well, I heard the Legionnaires were up there at the front gate, and the parking crew was sending messages down to bring a few other people up that could be maybe Shanti Sena or helpful in this. And I was up at the front gate, and there was all of one county sheriff's car and maybe a state police car, and there were all these Legionnaires on these two buses with beers, and they were starting to holler stuff at the hippies. Yeah, you got your hair done.
And to hear how that turned out, you can check out Positive Vibes Only on the at KBOO.FM. It is time now to move on for Sprouts right after these important messages. So stay tuned to KBOO Portland.
Are you bored or unsatisfied with your daily activities? Do you long for a new, exciting experience? If the answer is yes and you're under 21 just like me, then you should consider adding a once-a-week KBOO Youth Collective meeting to your schedule. Side effects will probably include extreme happiness, uncontrollable fits of laughter, a great group of new friends, and yummy snacks. KBOO Youth Collective can cause sudden bouts of inspiration and a yearning to share your words or your inner thoughts with the local community. If joining the collective sounds like a cure for your boredom and lack of an extraordinary after-school activity, then write us at youth@kboo.org or visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, or come into one of our Wednesday meetings for a scare-free, risk-free, and always cost-free trial.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 1st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
Press the button to begin.
PDX Short Docs is a 2-hour program of Portland-related short documentaries by local